You're listening to an encore edition of Studio Tulsa recorded earlier this year. Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. My guest today was a part of a group of 22 noted scientists that published a groundbreaking paper in Nature back in 2011 that argued that Earth was entering a tipping point in our biosphere with major catastrophic ecological effects on the horizon. With human population growth, destruction of ecosystems, and climate change affecting the natural world, paleontologist Anthony Bernoski now warns that Earth may be entering the sixth mass extinction in his new book, Dodging Extinction: Power, Food, Money, and the Future of Life on Earth. Bernoski writes that extinction rates over the past 100 years, and especially over the past 50 years, have accelerated greatly, and today we've lost about 1% of the species that have existed on Earth over the last 12,000 years. Now, that doesn't sound like much, but more importantly, fully 20,000 of the world's researched 70,000 or so species are either critically endangered, endangered, or vulnerable. Yet Bernoski is cautiously optimistic that man can arrest this trend. He joins us today to talk about those solutions and the scope of the problem. He's a noted paleontologist and a professor of integrative biology, as well as a research paleoecologist at the University of California, Berkeley. And he joins us today to talk about his new book, Dodging Extinction. Anthony Bernoski, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
I'm happy to be here, Rich. Thank you.
Your research and work has led you to believe that we on Earth are either on the cusp of or perhaps in the beginning stages of what I guess most paleontologists would say the sixth mass extinction. What leads you to this conclusion?
Right. So we are at the beginning stages of what paleontologists would call a sixth mass extinction. And the reason we know that is because we can look at the rates of extinctions of species over the past century, and particularly over the past 50 years or so, and see that they are much, much elevated relative to the normal background rate of extinction. It's analogous to having a mass death of tens of thousands of people all at once versus the normal life cycle of births and deaths that would be gradual over time.
Now, when I think of a mass extinction, I'm thinking of extinction rates at 60, 70, 80, 90% of life on the planet. Are we talking about that sort of acceleration?
That's correct. A mass extinction, in sort of technical paleontological terms, would mean that three out of every four species that you're familiar with disappears off the face of the Earth. That's what we're heading towards. So far, we've only lost about 1% of species that we know about, and that's the good news. The bad news is that we've reduced the numbers of individuals in so many species that literally tens of thousands of species are now vulnerable to extinction if we keep culling their numbers as we have.
First of all, you mentioned what a mass extinction is, about 75% of the species. But how do we define species? Because one of the things you'll see in news reports, and I think you allude to it in the book, you referred to the Scottish Highland wildcats, or I'm not maybe getting the species a little wrong, but it's a subspecies of wildcats. And you say, you know, this subspecies is seriously threatened. You can see the slide. It's heading towards extinction of that population of wildcats, but wildcats in general are doing well. Are we counting that differently, or when we say a species, do we mean all wildcats or all elephants or African elephants as opposed to Asian elephants? What do we mean?
So when we talk about species vulnerable to extinction, we're talking about the entire species. As you just mentioned, species are made up of many distinct populations. Populations are made up of many individuals. What has happened over the past 40 years is we have killed about half of the wildlife populations on Earth. That means we've reduced the numbers of individuals and species by dramatic amounts. We have gone from, for example, 250,000 Galapagos tortoises down to about 2,000 before we started to build those back up by some good conservation efforts. And there's a species after species. You know, we've gone from over a million wild elephants in Africa down to about 450,000, and they're going so fast now that in 20 years there would be no wild elephants left on Earth if we kept up at that pace.
Now, when we talk about these eliminations of huge numbers of animals in a given species, this is not climate change for the most part. This is man intervening.
That is correct. So up to now, the species losses that we have seen don't even take into account climate change, which has been driving extinctions over the past century or so, are things like converting natural landscapes, that is, forests and prairies, to farms and cities and pasture lands. That's a big, big cause, habitat loss. The other thing is overexploitation of species that we can make money off of for the short term. That's the case with many of the world's fisheries. And that's also the case with the elephant example that I mentioned, and that's illegal activity. That's terrorist groups and drug lords running smuggling rings for ivory.
Yeah. In fact, it seems like at one point we thought we were out of the woods with illegal poaching, but with new technology and really the mechanization, I suppose, of poaching forces, that's actually accelerated greatly over the last maybe decade.
Yes, it has accelerated dramatically over the past decade. Part of it is technology, but part of it is the... it's kind of ironic. It's market demand in the illegal trade, right? The fewer individual animals there are, the higher the costs of those products go up. So it's more profitable. That's one thing. And then the other is that, particularly for the ivory trade, and also for things like rhinoceros horn, there has been rising economic situations in a lot of Asian countries that value these things highly. So there are more people that want those products.
Because they're illegal, that makes it all black market. It means that the prices are higher, so there's
exactly.
A greater reward in actually poaching.
Exactly, right.
I'm going to get back to the idea of a mass extinction, because mm-hmm. I was thinking about mass extinction. It seems like when I think of a mass extinction, I think of this happening over really long periods of time, multi-generational, and the fact that we can only sort of see a mass extinction in the rearview mirror. Is that necessarily correct, or can they happen quickly? I think of like maybe the asteroid impact that created the mass extinction that led to the end of the dinosaurs. I would think that happened in a short amount of time, but was it a long amount of time?
There have been 5 mass extinctions in the Earth's past half billion years. Most of those, 4 out of those 5, we don't have a good handle on exactly how long they took. We say they're rapid in geological time, but in reality that means over several tens of thousands of years at a minimum. The dinosaur extinction is an exception to that. That was a particularly bad afternoon when an asteroid hit the Earth, so that was very rapid, probably immediate devastation, and then within a few years afterwards, the after effects had wiped out about 75% of the animals and plants we know about. It's interesting you said, we tend to think of extinction as looking in the rearview mirror. Now we're in some ways, the enviable position of actually looking through the windshield and down the road and seeing it coming. The rapidity that this extinction event has actually is unrivaled by anything except that asteroid strike. If we kept going at the pace we're going right now, it would be a certainty that we would see a mass extinction within probably 3 to 4 human generations. However, it could be much faster than that, because that assumes that these impacts that we're seeing and that we know are having today are not going to increase. And as we add 3 billion more people to the planet by 2050, if we did nothing differently, they certainly would increase.
Now, one of the things you talk a little bit about the nomenclature of how we talk about a species in decline, and a lot of times you'll hear the word threatened, but really the two terms I think that scientists will refer to as endangered and vulnerable. What do we need to know about the nomenclature of species as far as when something is threatened? And threatened, I think, tends to be sort of a generic term from what I could see in the book.
The way the general public uses threatened, it is, you know, a generic term. It would just mean it's, you know, something bad could happen. The way scientists who study extinction use the word threatened actually has a very specific meaning. There's a group of scientists, a very large group, belonging to an organization called the International Union for the Conservation of Nature, and it is their task to evaluate the extinction risk of ideally all the species on Earth, but that's a big job, so only about 4% of species have been evaluated. That amounts to 75,000 species. And what happens is each of those species has been looked at in terms of how much their populations have been declining over the past several decades. And depending on the percentage decline and many other factors, they're classed into several different categories. There's extinct in the wild, which means there's only left in zoos. There's critically endangered, which basically means there's only a few individuals left of that species anywhere on Earth. There's endangered, which is in big trouble, but not quite as bad as critically endangered. And then there's vulnerable, which is also much reduced in numbers over what it should be. So the species that the IUCN classifies as vulnerable, endangered, or critically endangered are lumped together and called threatened.
Together, I think, according to the last mass survey, of 70,000 species they actually track, and, you know, there's probably more than 70,000 species, but that's how much scientists track, 20,000 were in those categories.
Yeah, so basically now scientists have evaluated somewhere around 75,000 species. Of those, well over 20,000 fall in that threatened group of species. So it's about a third of all the species that we know about. As you said, there's a lot of species, the majority of species on Earth, we haven't even had time to study yet, and they are disappearing before we can even learn about them.
Yeah. You were part of a research group that published the paper in Nature that sort of talked about the fact that we are in the sixth mass extinction. We have pretty good records on the last 500 years, I guess, of documenting the loss of species. Can you give us a sense of how this rate has increased over the last 100 years and especially over the last 50 years?
The rate of loss of species has been increasing over the past 500 years. Right now, the most conservative estimates would say that the extinction rates are probably they're certainly higher than about 12 times too fast, and at 12 times too fast, we would be seeing a mass extinction take place within a couple of centuries. Some people have done studies that suggest they're 100 or even 1,000 times too fast.
Wow.
So, and what we see is if we calculate that rate over, say, 500 years, and then calculate it only over the last 100 years, we see the rate over the last 100 years is actually increasing relative to thinking about it over the longer term of time. So we're having more and more effects as there's more and more people on the planet.
My guest today is Anthony Barnofsky, a professor of integrative biology and a research paleoecologist at the University of California, Berkeley. He's the author of Dodging Extinction, Power, Food, Money, and the Future of Life on Earth. He said, even though you consider yourself an optimistic, and you say there's ways we can change this, and one of the things you did is you sort of looked at the issues that are affecting animal and plant species, and that's mainly man, and mainly our demand for higher living standards, better living standards for an increasing population. And that gets into food, it gets into power, and you did a lot of research just sort of following people around in the course of working to make sure that, you know, there's lights are turned on, that there's enough food for an increasing human population. Mm-hmm. What did you find?
Well, the main drivers of extinction, I sort of put into the three categories of power. That is how we produce enough energy to keep the global society going in the way we've been accustomed. Food, which is how we can produce enough food to feed the 3 billion more people that are going to be on the planet inevitably by 2050 without taking over more of the habitat available now to other species. And then money, the issue of changing our economic model so that we view nature not as a bottomless checking account where we can just keep withdrawing funds, but more as an investment account where we're living off of the interest. And basically, if you begin to think about it in those terms, you find that in order to prevent the sixth mass extinction, there are three things we have to do. Well, actually, there are more than three, but...
three big ones.
The three big ones. One, we have to get off of fossil fuels as fast as possible, because the amount of climate change that we are causing is more than species existing on Earth have ever experienced since they became species, and that includes humans. We have to be more efficient in how we're growing food in areas where we're already growing food and not take over more natural landscapes, because really the only arable land left are places like rainforests, which hold about two-thirds of the Earth's remaining land-based species.
Or fairly arid places requires lots of water.
Exactly, yeah. So we have to do more in the areas we've already got under cultivation. And it turns out that is entirely possible to do to increase production. Africa, for example, in most parts of Africa, you could increase production by almost 75%. And there are many other places in the world like that. And then wasting less food and eating less meat are part of that equation, too. And again, it's all possible to do if we pay attention to it and do it in ways more efficiently than we have been. And then the third thing is changing the overall economic model so that we're actually putting a price tag on what we use for nature and viewing it as this long-term investment account rather than the checking account.
Well, given the current price of oil, I don't think the first is that easy. Perhaps food is a little easier, and the idea of changing economics is also a pretty hard, it will be a hard thing to achieve.
Well, you know, that's an interesting one. If you look at what the biggest corporations in the world are thinking about, they in fact are moving towards exactly that goal. The most powerful corporations in the world are part of a group called the World Business Council for Sustainable Development. And they've actually put together a plan to address many of these issues, which with decade-by-decade milestones. So, in fact, people at the top are thinking very seriously about how to achieve these things. And I think, really, you put your finger on something that's very important, is that most of us say, oh, gosh, these are such big things, we can't do anything. But in fact, when people become aware of these issues and just begin to think about them in a little bit different way, it's amazing how fast good changes can happen.
We really haven't talked about climate change and how this is likely to affect this extinction rate. I think most people would say it's going to affect it badly, but, you know, humans are an adaptable species. I would think a lot of animal and plant species are adaptable as well. You know, I think of just in my urban environment, things like, you know, we think of a coyote as being a very adaptable species.
Sure.
We think of a fox as less so, but I'm driving down my car in Midtown Tulsa, and there's a fox walking across the street. And I'm talking about vertebrates, and I'm in, you know, big mammal species as opposed to, you know, tiny little species that may not be that adaptable. Mm-hmm. How adaptable are our animal and plant species to some of these changes?
Well, I mean, there's no doubt that, you know, there will be winners, there will be losers, but overall, there's going to be a lot more losers than winners. And the reason for that is because we are changing climate at a rate that is 10 times faster than most living species have experienced since they became a species. And there's a speed limit on evolution, so they can't really adapt fast enough in terms of undergoing the amount of genetic changes that would be required. Now, another response that species have always had to climate change, of course, is just to move to a different place. They can't do that in most cases because we have now converted about 50% of what were formerly habitats available to other species to habitats that we mainly utilize. So that takes a lot of the land area out of play and puts up a lot of barriers to moving from one place to another. So that response is not available anymore. And then we're hitting some very delicate and highly biodiverse areas very hard with climate change. So tropical and subtropical regions, in fact, are really going to change a lot relative to the stability they have seen in the past. And coral reefs, there are, from warming of the oceans and acidification, there's a very good chance that there will be almost no coral reefs left on Earth by the year 2070. Now, that means that 25% of the species in the sea are gone, which also means 10% of the world's fisheries are gone.
You know, which means there will be famine.
They're lost from the world economy.
Yeah. Well, you know, the other thing I was reading about in the book is, you know, you detail a particular subspecies of, I believe it was a Galapagos turtle.
Tortoise, yes.
Yeah, tortoise. And it was Lonesome George. He was the last of his particular kind, a giant tortoise that were once very abundant. And this is the other thing, is that, you know, we may have some species left, but once they reach a critical limit, there's not much you can do to save them or reverse that. Perhaps the California condor may be one of the few success stories like that, but it requires massive human intervention to reverse a species decline once they hit a certain level.
Yeah, that's absolutely right, and it's for that reason that the really only guard against mass extinction is to not let species drop to the level of, say, a California condor, where then really the amount of money and effort it takes is just phenomenal. I mean, there's no way we could do that for, say, 25,000 species. So keeping it from hitting that point is really critical.
And of course, once you lose a species, you're also you're threatening some other species that depend on that animal for either food, for carrion, or waste products from that animal, and so it sort of creates a revolving chain.
That's right. Yeah. So you know, species don't exist in a vacuum. All species depend on some other species to some extent. And really, the coral reef example I just mentioned is a great illustration of that. You know, by killing the coral species, you end up causing all this collateral damage that wipes out all of these other dependent species as well.
Well, what gives you the most cause for optimism? Several times in the book, you say, you know, I'm optimistic about us being able to change our influence on the natural world to avoid a true sixth mass extinction. What are the things that give you the most optimism?
Yeah, and, you know, I would say I have guarded optimism. and the things that give me that guarded optimism are looking at the way the global society has been able to handle similarly big problems in the past once they've realized their problems. And I always like to bring up the Green Revolution in this regard. It's a nice example. In the 1960s, it was very clear that a billion or so people were going to be dead from starvation in about a decade if the world didn't cooperate and do something about it.
We remember that you could literally get burns from swimming in the Hudson River, and now you can swim in the Hudson River.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, some of our pollution problems are other good examples. So once people are aware of an important global-sized problem and buy into it, the human species is incredible at fixing things. I mean, we have huge amounts of technological expertise, human ingenuity. You know, we actually do for climate change, for example. We know exactly what to do. We have most of the technology, and we know that by as early as 2040, we could be pretty much off of fossil fuels if we wanted to do that. Not to say it's easy, but it's very doable. So those are the things that give me a bit of optimism on this, and this is why I think it's so important for people to become aware of the risk we are now at. We have a very narrow window of time in which to start making these changes and start moving towards them. Otherwise, we get to that point where you were, you know, talking about the California condor, where there's just populations are going to be so reduced that it's going to be very tough to dig ourselves out of the mess.
And as you write in the last chapter, it says, what's bad for the natural world and other species is also bad for us.
Absolutely. Those same three issues that I bring up, power, food, and money, if we made the adjustments that would help save other species, it would be a much more pleasant world for humans as well.
All right. The name of the book is Dodging Extinction, Power, Food, Money, and the Future of Life on Earth. It's published by the University of California Press. Anthony Barnofsky, thanks very much for joining us.
Yeah, it was my pleasure. Thank you for the conversation.
Anthony Barnofsky is a professor of integrative biology and a research paleoecologist at the University of California, Berkeley, the author of Dodging Extinction, Power, Food, Money, and the Future of Life on Earth. It's published by the University of California Press. While his solutions seem very difficult for man to achieve, he does offer three small steps that most families can take. Eat less meat and eat grass-fed meat when you do. Before purchasing fish, check the Monterey Bay Aquarium Seafood Watch for species that are sustainably harvested, and try to avoid foods and products with palm oil, though that is difficult because it's in a huge array of products. But if you do purchase it, make sure it's with a producer that purchased palm oil from existing plantations than newly deforested plantations. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.